New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Ivo Henning. Thank you so much for joining us today. So you're a strategist, producer, artist, programmer, consultant, and you've worked in a broad array of situations and environments, from entrepreneurial startups to NGOs. But it seems like if we had to really distill what you do down, it would be to focus on collective intelligence and flipping inefficient models and systems that don't really work. And at least that's where I'd like to focus, with the goal to bring back how your broad and diverse experience and insights could filter against an entertainment landscape and the change that's currently disrupting the entertainment landscape. So that's sort of how I'd like to frame our conversation today, because you have such a wide...
It's a broad background, yes.
Very, very broad.
Focusing on participation, engagement, and interactivity, I would say, is a great place to start.
Fantastic. So, yes, this engagement, user experience, it's something that's a bit of a North Star for video publishers. And I had seen a video you had done online about old code, new code, and experience. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit around that.
Sure. Well, many of us grow up receiving the old code, right? We are taught to believe very specific things about the world and how it works. And what we learn over time is that the deeper creative work of trying to create a new paradigm or a new system or a new model requires us to work differently. And it's more collaborative. And opening the doors to participation is really the key to beginning to be aware of new code being that which we're generating now, not just what's been given to us, right? So we have the old code of our heritage and our DNA and the systems and stories that we've been sharing throughout generations. And then we have this new reality that's being created, right? So the programmers and the virtual reality builders and all of those overlays that are sitting on top, that we're becoming more aware of each other and of what we might possibly share. But sometimes when we are tuning into that new code, we don't know what to do with that information. And we often revert back to what we thought we knew about the old code, about the ways we thought people could work well together. The problem has been that the old code isn't very collaborative. We often get stuck in these very old models of what we think is going to work. So we end up, for instance, with programming around one speaker who's going to talk to a large group of people, but not necessarily ask questions or engage participation. And what we're seeing right now with gaming, for instance, is that people really want to interact and engage and try and tackle big problems together. We like tearing apart questions and figuring things out. And sometimes our media is slow to create those opportunities for us. What we see emerging in the VR space and in many of these more interactive environments is that the hunger for deeper collaboration and engagement is starting to pop up in new channels. Traditional media models don't know what to do with that. They don't have a space for it. And so we have the new code, the streaming model, the being able to go straight to web and tell the world exactly what you think, the ability to create your own content on top of someone else's world. And so there is a lot of ego play that comes along with that struggle. There's a lot of programming challenge around how do we create the right environment where we can figure these things out together? How do we begin to collaborate if we can't even really see each other effectively? And how do we create the space for that play, because so much of it is around play and discovery and learning to experiment together in new ways.
When you say play, you mean it very literally, yes?
Yes.
And this is, I think, something that certainly in another guest we had spoken to who deals with immersive theater was talking about how playfulness was important in terms of getting people engaged in what he was doing. And I thought that was really interesting. And so it then was also interesting, you know, in your other interviews that you've had where you spoke about playfulness. How can one actually, though, in a corporate way, create playfulness? Isn't playfulness almost the absence of structure? Can you create structures that create an environment for playfulness?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is what we're seeing with innovation challenges happening inside large companies as well. So playfulness is something that you can bring into any environment. It's a way of being and working together that invites participation, that encourages discovery, that makes it fun to be together and makes it more interesting to bring other people into that process. But you can do it in a corporate conference room the same way you do it online if you create the structure for it. And it does, play does have a structure. Sometimes it's a very loose structure, right? Like improvisation has a couple of very simple rules. And so you can take the rules of improvisation and bring them into the conference room. You can create design challenges that encourage people to think differently about problems that are already existing in your ecosystem. So whether it's an innovation challenge that you're dealing with in your office, or you're trying to bring a new media project to life and you're trying to figure out, well, how can I let people toy with this world? How can we sculpt it together? How can I invite user-generated content in a way that feels enriching to the whole? Well, that's where play comes in, because you want to invite, you want to say, hey, come do something with us, and let's see what we discover together. And it doesn't have to be about the out there. It can be about the question and the process and about making it safer for that process to happen with groups.
So is that something that you can, I can see how that would work internally in an organization, but how could an organization create playfulness for the consumer, to engage the consumer with them and their content? Is that something that can be done? And also, how do you ensure that the play is seen as authentic and real and not just sort of lip service? I mean, I guess even that would speak to the corporate as well. Like, oh, great, we're going to, you know, we've got to go to the conference room and do some improv, and then, you know, Jane in accounting will ruin it anyway, or what have you, you know. That it's sort of one of these things people will participate in, and it will be that thing they did over there on the left, but will then continue being mindless drones on the right anyway. So how do we make play authentic when it's happening internally, not only authentic, but that it actually then results in actionable change? And then how can we leverage play to create higher levels of engagement?
Well, being able to balance the invitation to creativity with the risk associated with being creative, that is the challenge, especially in the workplace, right? Because if you have tons of new ideas, but they're not being well received, you don't want to put those ideas into the group anymore, right? It feels like it's an already closed environment. And many corporations feel this way, right? That's why innovation becomes the stagnant process. And so you have to be able to figure out how to get the guards down a little bit. And sometimes it's around designing games or challenges or opportunities for people to work together in new ways. But it often does have to happen outside of the traditional work environment, right? Because that's where it feels sometimes too risky to put yourself forward, even if you've got great ideas. And so opening up the collaborative and collective environment to play sometimes means you got to go outside and do something different. And sometimes it means you want to put people together who've never worked together just to see what happens and give them something interesting or different to do. Often that's a media challenge because media is one of those places where we get to discover each other and video, especially video, gaming, any type of interactive media where there is a conversation happening and then opened up to others, then creates the beginnings of that invitation space, that opening space. And the opening space is what starts the process of allowing ideas to start to flow. And you can't get the idea flow going in a completely stagnant environment. So you have to figure out, well, what is the environment that's going to support the joy that we want to bring in, the passion we want to bring into our flow? And once you've nailed down, well, let's go out to the woods together, or let's take a day and let's try this a different way, right? Let's rethink the way we've been going at this. Sometimes it's just as simple as putting a new challenge in front of people. Sometimes it's a bigger game that you ask everyone to play together. And that can happen in a corporate environment or in a conference or even online.
And it's seen as authentic and real. People don't go away into the woods, have fun, and then come back to work and nothing's really different.
It depends on how you do it, right? So, right. So, I mean, it's the same in marketing, right? So if you're a corporation and you're putting out a game or a challenge just as a marketing ploy, people understand that and they see it and, you know, they're going to call you on it as well, right? If you're just trying to get more email addresses for your random spam list, people get that. They see it and they don't want to participate. But if you offer an opportunity for their participation to be heard and possibly brought into something meaningful, then you've opened a door.
Right.
And that open door feels like a completely different opportunity because all of a sudden you're listening to your customers, you're listening to your audience, and you want to hear them, right? If they feel that you want to hear them and you want to share them too, they are far more likely to share you with others. And it doesn't matter if you're trying to sell something or not. That magnetism of joy. And joy can happen in a corporate environment or in a political, in a government environment, or in a completely social environment. It doesn't have to happen out in the woods or at the beach. But it does require a level of openness that is hard to get to if it's a completely structured experience. How to design for the open space and the invitation to play, most media companies haven't quite nailed yet. They're going for very low levels of participation, right? Vote yes or no, vote for your favorite idol, give us your email address and we'll send you a coupon, right? These are extremely low bars to reach.
Right.
We haven't asked that much of our audience and our community yet. In terms of real engagement and participation, like, let's open up a huge challenge and figure out how to solve it together. I think this is why we see movement toward things like the X Prize and a lot of smaller challenges too, because people want to do meaningful work together and they want it to be fun and rewarding and valuable. And if you can create some sort of experience that lets people feel that their play and their collaboration is valuable, then that's a win. That's the game. And it doesn't matter what environment it's in.
So also along with experience, there's I've been noticing a common thread among the people I've been talking to about authenticity and humanity. And I know that you have also talked a certain amount about humanity and making sure we don't lose the humanity. And some of that goes a bit to what you had been saying almost about old code. We don't leave it behind. We understand it. We incorporate it. We bring it in. And so why do you think that people seem to be disconnected a bit with their own humanity? And then why is it important? Why does it matter?
This has been an ongoing challenge. this is a tough question to answer here. I have experienced a number of ways in which we have given so much of ourselves and our trust in ourselves over to our devices that at times we do not trust ourselves and our own senses, right? So we are more likely to trust information that comes from our phone than comes from our own senses in many cases.
That's very, you know, it's funny you should say that. My son, the other day, I said something about it was raining, and he said, no, it's not. And I said, yeah, it is. He said, well, the weather app says it's not raining. And I said, well, the sky says it's raining, because he was just looking at his device. And it was, and he wasn't being ironic particularly. And that was, but that was a child. So I'm hoping that, I mean, if that's where we are as a society, I think we've got some pretty significant problems.
We do. We have transferred so much of our trust to the collective intelligence and to our devices that we haven't always fully trusted ourselves. And so to tell you a quick story, I had surgery in February, and it happened to be at a hospital where there was a Bitcoin ransomware hack, the first one that happened. And so the entire time I was in the hospital, there were no functioning computers.
Oh my God.
And they didn't tell us what was happening, only that we saw these skulls and crossbones on every computer in the hospital.
Oh, the hospital, fantastic. And,
right? So that we knew that the computers were poisoned, but we didn't understand what was going on. But what I kept seeing was, you know, very talented medical professionals constantly second-guessing themselves, not sure what to do, trying to go back to paper models, and really, they were afraid to trust their own instincts. And that, to me, was scary because, you know, any sort of information system has vulnerabilities, right?
Yeah.
And if we forget to trust ourselves and our collective ability as humans to do things without our devices, then we're in serious trouble, right?
Yeah.
So I asked Cory Doctorow, I was like, do you think we're giving too much of our trust away? And he felt like it wasn't as much of a problem because of the vast capacity that collective intelligence, that, you know, having your device there at a moment's notice, able to solve a problem for you, gives us, right? That is a huge opportunity to solve problems collectively in real time. And that's extraordinary. But we have to also remember that we are extraordinary and that we have so much more sensory input coming in that we need to also trust our own senses and trust each other, especially in the room together.
Mm. Well, it's also interesting, the trusting in devices or data over human experience. There was a blog post today somebody shared with me about creativity and the loss and lack of creativity in advertising, that advertising was getting worse and creativity was being devalued and commoditized. And the writer thought that there was a parallel linkage between these two things. And I think that perhaps speaks a bit to the humanity and the need to understand that there are some things that maybe machines don't do or we don't want them to do.
Yes.
And perhaps he didn't see a problem with collective intelligence because it wasn't him in the hospital when the computers had skulls and crossbones on it. You know, so the understanding of the vulnerability of systems, I think that's another thing. I use my kid as sort of, he's my foil for half these things I'm always talking about, but he has great trust in the, not all, obviously the weather, he trusts his app more than the actual sky, but he also believes that things will always work. Planes will run on time, things will happen. And whereas I'm always like, you know, well, you know, the plane will be delayed, so be ready for it. You know, you don't want your flights too tightly planned or what have you. He thinks things are going to work. And I think they'll break down. So, you
know. Voice of experience.
Well,
we understand that systems are vulnerable and they are only as good as the humans who are also working with them. And if we don't know how to collaborate when our systems fail, we're really screwed.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that we talk about is flipping inefficient models and systems, making them more efficient. And that's a great thing to say. But executing it is challenging. So
right.
What are the key ways in which organizations can change in order to be more efficient?
Right. So one piece we've focused on is empowering virtual work while also improving collaboration, right? So what we've seen is that more and more of us are working from home or while traveling. Some work environments support that level of virtual engagement and encourage it because it reduces travel costs, it reduces carbon in the atmosphere, and there are a number of ways in which virtual work can make us better. But if we don't know how to collaborate effectively in that environment, then it feels like a wash and a waste. So, for instance, with virtual work, that being just one of the ways in which we are able to make good use of this efficiency, right? We know that it's far cheaper to host a virtual summit than to try and bring 300 people from all over the world together to one place. We know that there's a vast cost difference. We know that there's a huge energetic cost difference. And we know that it's easier on most people to just hop on a virtual call for an hour or come into a virtual experience for an hour. That opportunity is huge.
But doesn't that fly into the face of the whole humanity? I mean, I think when I've worked on teams, if I've met people and have some human connection with them, then I can work virtually. But if I've never met them before, it's far trickier.
Right. And what we found was the hack around that is embodiment in virtuality, right? So we started this work in Second Life and doing different research into virtual environments and what would help for collaboration. And so I would host meetings in lots of different virtual rooms, some of them being outdoors or by a drum circle or while meditating, and some of them being more traditional environments like a conference room or an auditorium. And what we found was certain types of virtual experiences help people bond even if they never meet. So if their avatar is physically embodied doing something with other physically embodied avatars, they feel like they've been together in physical space. If they hear each other's voices and see each other's avatars moving, it creates that not exactly the same connectedness, but those bonds do last, and they last, and they are far richer than what we experience on most social networks or on sort of the 2D meet space of the internet. And it's the embodiment plus the activity that changes the experience. But there's very little research into this, and understanding collaborative flow in virtual environments is, I mean, very few people are even tapping into this power yet.
Well, that's fascinating. If you think about all of the kids who are playing games together, again, my kid playing Xbox with a bunch of other boys, you know, playing these games where they're, you know, fighting and hunting and doing things. And at first I was very against it and I didn't like it. But one of the things I thought turned out to be interesting is so much of our space around what young men are able to do or aren't able to do in society has been really eliminated. It's not, you know, we don't fight, we don't do this, we don't do that. And so the esprit de corps and warrior tribe doesn't really happen with young men. And yet now with these virtual games, they are going on missions together, you know, this group. Ooh. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that makes them as young adults, as adults, if they'll be any different.
Yes. And the power of the guild over the long haul is it's amazing to see what guilds can do. Some of these friendships last for decades, and we're starting to see this with World of Warcraft guilds that have been together over 10 years. The gameplay allows them to be better collaborators because they already understand each other's strengths and vulnerabilities. They understand how to play to that and how to work with it. So gameplay can be training for figuring out how to work together more effectively.
Well, that's fascinating also because whereas sports used to be something kids would do on their own, adults have become very involved in managing it. Yet the gameplay is still very much their own self-directed experience. That's interesting how that would then change how they work. And I'd never really thought about virtual engagement as being a way that you could then learn how to work collaboratively remotely. That's fascinating.
Well, it opens up so many of those capacities we didn't think we had because it is that wide open canvas, right? So if you look at something like High Fidelity Now, which you can get into most VR headsets, you can create anything you want. It's like an adult Minecraft. So having that blank canvas is really exciting to some people, especially when combined with the social capacity of being able to do something with others. So I think we're going to see a huge jump in social VR and learning to create collaboratively and then translating that into the commons. We've already seen this happen in Second Life, for instance, with projects we did with Egyptian architects and the State Department here in the U.S., figuring out how to redesign the public commons for deeper engagement, but doing so in virtual worlds and putting architects into virtual environments with others to experiment and figure it out.
Oh, so you mean they would create virtually, then they would determine what to execute. So they were eventually going to execute in the real world?
Right, right. So these architecture students worked with their professor in Cairo to redesign what the public commons should be like. And then with trips to Los Angeles, with a collaboration with USC and the State Department, they were then able to begin to unlock that and figure out, well, how should this change what we're doing at Giza, for instance? How do we create public space for the world to come and engage with us in a way that doesn't feel so closed off?
Interesting. And it was with a purpose to increase the engagement, because certainly that in the 70s, I think it was 70s Harvard, when they were building some of their dorms, I believe they designed them to frustrate engagement, if you will.
Right, right. And that has been used in some governments to keep people away from each other, right? So we see some countries where the commons is a growing space for collaboration, and we see other countries where the commons is being shut down because of government control and fear.
Right, right. So when you're setting up a disruptive internal team, you're giving them parameters around who the goal is for. I mean, how structured and parametered, and what are the time attachments to generate solutions?
Right. So for me, every client is different. I tend to take on the up to 3-month type of engagements where I can come in a short period of time and do something interesting, whether it's an experiment or a new pilot, or to help flip a team and help them go in a new direction. The EXO Works model is a 10-week innovation sprint that's done with coaching from around the world. So the internal team then creates a group from their different departments of people who are already change-focused and are ready to take that ball and run with it. And then we give them the tools and the power and all of that information on how to begin to put those pieces together and then how to bring it back into the organization and make it a value proposition that everyone wants to be a part of.
Right, right. Right.
But yes, a season is roughly I would say at least a season to formulate. And then you know, change management takes a very different time frame depending on the size of the organization.
Right. Of course. Of course. One of the things I like to do with guests is I like to give them words and have them give me top of mind responses. It's just entertaining for me, really. And I find it kind of interesting. So I'm going to just toss out some words. Tell me what you think. Okay.
Sure.
Facebook.
Chatty.
Snapchat.
Oh, I don't have time.
Twitter.
Addiction.
YouTube.
Fun.
Ad blockers.
Salvation.
Art.
Joy.
AI.
Interesting opportunities.
VR.
Blank space.
Interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next. I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have been indispensable to bringing the program to life. First and foremost is the incomparable voice artist and my friend, Rob Naughton. Thank you. Our production team over at Microfame Media. Thank you. And a big thank you to our guest and new friend, Ivo Henning. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience. Thank you. We'll be talking to you next week right here on Up Next.